WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I've been in the news business for a few years now, and here's a statistic that I found interesting. I'm not blind to the fact that TikTok is a thing, a huge thing, but a third of American adults under 30 regularly get their news from TikTok. That caught my attention, to say the least. I came across that figure in a piece by my colleague Claire Malone, who covers media for the New Yorker. And Claire writes this: more and more voters are forming opinions based on the funny video that their cousin's husband's sister shared in the group chat. In other words, whether I like it or not, memes matter. Claire Malone joins us now. Claire, one of the quotes in your piece just stays with me. A right-wing influencer says the following: the left can't meme, but we can. What does that mean?
It basically means the left is too self-righteous and sanctimonious and worried about being politically correct that they can't be funny. But the right wing can be funny and go there. They can say the things everyone thinks but doesn't actually say out loud. I think that's what he means there.
I see. And is he right?
I think there's some truth to it, sure, yeah. I mean, I think that there's one of the reasons why, you know, I talked to this professor, Ryan Milner, who studies memes. He's an academic memologist. And
you can make a living at that?
And he basically said, you know, like, the reason why right-wing memes are so successful is because in American right-wing ideology of 2024, it's a very black and white thing, right? You know, fluid gender identity is a total joke. We all know that. That's the right-wing thinking. So we can make the funny joke that, frankly, probably elicits a lot of maybe inappropriate laughter from people who consider themselves Democrats, but they wouldn't maybe make the joke themselves. But I think the right wing has, what's the phrase we all like to say, has created a permission structure for that kind of humor because it is a more black and white ideology. This is how America should be. This is how it shouldn't be.
So let's start with this meme of Biden's birthday cake and other age-related memes.
This is a picture of Joe Biden that was posted on his Instagram. He turned 81 in November, mm-hmm. and it is a birthday cake absolutely alight, engulfed in flames.
It looks like a forest fire on top of a chocolate cake.
That's right. And Biden is sitting there smiling at a glossy mahogany table. And the caption says, "Turns out on your 146th birthday, you run out of space for candles." Okay.
That's all in good fun.
Basically, the Biden campaign has realized that he will not get younger. And so the way to deal with concerns about his age is to make jokes about it.
That joke is showing up on Joe Biden's official Instagram account, right?
That's right. Yeah. So that's their way of sort of counteracting some of these, there are a lot of memes on the internet of Joe Biden tripping over his words or maybe looking confused. The RNC actually put an ad or a YouTube ad that sort of spliced them all together. I think those are a little bit unfair. I mean, one, Joe Biden suffers from a stutter or has kind of overcome a stutter throughout his life. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's some of that going on with his speech patterns. But yes, there are various things beyond just the Biden tripping on the internet that makes him look old or fumbling or feeble.
A recent poll shows that 77% of American adults think that Biden is too old for a second term. So is that meme helping Biden?
I think it's, I should say, with those poll numbers, it's also a majority of Democrats or a plurality of Democrats. I mean, most people think this he's too old. I mean, I think it's...
Trump is a spring chicken of what, 77?
He's 4 years younger than Biden.
And looks fabulous.
I think we're dealing with an American public that is upset. I would say that both of their candidates are...
of an age.
Old. Let's use the word, David. Old by any standard.
So online, we're not seeing left-leaning memes at all when it comes to politics?
We are. You know, I think the most prominent one, which I do talk about in the piece, is the Dark Brandon meme.
So explain what that is.
Okay. It's complicated. So it's... The Dark Brandon meme is a left-wing meme derived from the right-wing meme, Let's Go Brandon. Let's Go Brandon is a polite way of saying F Joe Biden. So the Dark Brandon meme sprung up on what we call dirtbag left Twitter. And it was basically any time Joe Biden got sort of a policy win early in his administration, sort of to counteract the feeble narrative of Joe Biden, these guys, and they're mostly guys, would tweet out images of, like, Biden in his aviator but with lasers coming out of his eyes, or, like, Emperor Palpatine hands shooting out thunderbolts. And it was basically like, he's not a daughter and grandpa. He's this sort of powerful dark lord who gets it done in Washington. And the campaign now sells T-shirts of the Dark Brandon meme.
Now, you say that the right does this better. They're better at memes, or at least your source did in this piece. And at the same time, there seems to be memes all over the internet about Trump's affection for fast food, for example.
So I think the sort of famous meme is when he invited the Clemson football team after they'd won the national championship. They came to the White House during a partial government shutdown.
Right.
And so Trump on, you know, Washington silver, served them the McDonald's, Domino's, just like a host of fast food. And there's an amazing picture of him with his arms outstretched, basically.
So that meme works for him, not against Biden.
I mean, it was sort of affectionately. There were certainly, you know, liberals who made fun of him on Twitter. You know, people have been making fun of Trump for his bad eating habits and appearance for a long time. But then people on the right were like, you elitist. This man is in touch with the pulse of America. People like fast food, and so does Donald Trump. And like,
you might not have a pulse after that meal, but you can. It's relatable, as they say.
It's relatable, and he, you know, he leans in. He knows that he is a figure of, he's a caricature, and he knows that.
I mean, and plays with it.
Yeah, and in fact, if you look at when he was booked and had his mugshot taken, right, he had that sort of famous glowering to the camera picture.
Which he apparently rehearsed.
Yes. and I think we could all tell that. Yeah, you know, it's sort of it is an amazing visual representation of our time. And Trump tweeted it out himself.
So it became a meme for him everywhere.
It became a meme. I mean, it was basically then made into T-shirts. Sure, people on the left wing made fun of him, but Trump knew that was going to happen. He knew it was going to be the news of the day. And he very cannily asserted his own control over it and gave...
And his outlaw cred.
Exactly. His outlaw cred gave his supporters basically signal to them, this is how we're going to handle this. This is going to be our line of response.
So is the meme format uniquely effective at taking something that in the old sense would be bad coverage and turning it into a positive?
It can be. I mean, it can spin both ways. Memes are basically like the updated political cartoon, right? I mean, you know, so...
Which barely exists anymore.
Which, you know, yeah, here.
I mean, political cartoons used to be a staple of what used to be called newspapers across the country. And everybody had a Herb Block or a Tolles or whomever. And it's a smaller tribe now.
I think that there, you know, you can be hurt by memes as a politician, as I think Biden probably is.
Do any memes ever end up hurting Trump, or is he just immune from that because of the nature of his, I don't know, his persona?
I think he is probably hurt by them to a certain extent, but to a lesser degree, lesser degree.
Which one's hurt?
I do think, well, let me back up and say that I think it's all... impacted by polarization. So I do think there is a slice of people who are ambivalent about whether or not they're going to vote for Trump. And I think you could, for some of those people, the memes of him, you know, the mugshot, or when Trump sort of, you know, is talking back to the Manhattan judge, or, you know, making sort of puerile statements, like those are things that I think can go out into the ether. And some people will say, you know, if they're a supporter of his, look at this guy. He's like really sticking it to the man. It's mm-hmm. a witch hunt. And other people will be like, geez, this guy. I mean, is this really what we, you know, the accumulation of bad stuff is going to happen all over again if we reelect him. And by the way, when I reached out to the Biden campaign to ask for their response, they basically said, you know, our internal polling shows that most, you know, target voters, that's what they used.
And what does that mean?
It means basically, I think, like independents who are potentially swayable towards Biden.
In crucial states.
Yes. Well, they didn't specify, but I think we could probably infer that. Most of those people think, aren't sure that Donald Trump is going to win the Republican primary. And the implication there was, once they do realize that he's going to be the nominee for president, there's a good likelihood they're going to get sick of him. And it's not so much a defense of against Joe Biden being old so much as a, well, people are going to be annoyed by Trump again. Well, and they'll forget about how much they think Biden is too old for office.
In the Quinnipiac poll, he comes out 6% ahead of Trump in the popular vote. Now, that's yet to be confirmed by other polls. We'll see how this matches up with others. It's polls themselves, as we've learned to our absolute devastation.
Or how they do in swing states.
How they do in swing states. It's a momentary phenomenon, to be sure. But this is the first poll that he's had that is at all encouraging to the Democratic Party in a very long time. Does humor and memes have any effect on voters, do you think?
I mean,
it's okay if we're just having a good time.
I mean, my theory about American politics is, especially in the past, you know, decade, is basically none of it's really policy. It's all political pheromones. You like the cut of the person's jib. You kind of like, yeah, that guy. And that's really what it's all about. So if the person parries back with humor that you like and it seems to be done well and it's not corny, then maybe it works.
Or vicious,
yes.
Well, that's baked into the brand, too. I hate to combine two cliches in one short sentence. Let's turn to something much more important than the 2024 election and the stakes of democracy in general, Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce. Now, this romance has become a kind of cottage industry of conspiracy thinking. What has been showing up online, and what are the key memes there? let's just take it really low here. I mean, enough with this high-minded stuff.
This one I didn't actually see this one coming, which, shame on me.
Exactly.
Basically, the new conspiracy theory is that Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift's romance is a Democratic or maybe deep state operation to win Joe Biden the presidency, because if both of them endorse Joe Biden, then it will be
unfair,
I guess, a coup. It will, you know, the idea is basically like the NFL and Taylor Swift are, you know, along with complaining about airlines, the thing that all Americans can get behind.
That noted left-wing organization, the National Football League.
Right. Right. But this was going, I mean, this wasn't just like a meme in like, you know, weird right-wing Reddit.
No, it was on Fox. It's been on Fox every night.
Yeah.
Dark Brandon doesn't get bogged down on details. He can't name a Taylor Swift song. Taylor Swift can't name a Biden policy. This relationship was engineered in a lab. And Taylor's boyfriend, sponsored by Pfizer. It is a match made in corporate heaven. Could you imagine if the Chiefs win the Super Bowl?
Does any of this mean anything? Or is it just, you know, a little bone for us to chew on for a while?
I think it might be a bone for us to chew on, maybe some Super Bowl promo.
And here we are chewing on it like mad. Yeah.
I mean, I was just, Ross Douthat had a little thing in the New York Times, and I think he made a pretty good point, which was basically Taylor Swift has endorsed in an election before. She endorsed in the midterms in, I think, 2018, and her candidate lost, you know. So it's not, I mean, again, Tennessee is a deep red state, and that's where she sort of made a very public endorsement. but will Taylor Swift swing in the 2024 election? Hey, okay, maybe not. But maybe, you know, Biden is sort of unappealing to younger voters. Maybe if Taylor's, I don't know, just getting out the vote in Wisconsin.
Is there any history of a celebrity endorsement having a decisive impact, either in the era of memes or before?
I don't know. I want to say, like, maybe during the Obama era, but that was really more like certain political influencers in the primary kind of said to, like, to vote to black voters in particular, it's okay to vote for him. Like, you should.
Oh, but John Lewis was,
right.
Was
he's not.
Not
I'm
a
not
celebrity
like. Was,
as
no,
such.
I know. But was I'm trying now. I'm trying to. And you know better than I. Like, was Oprah so early?
That's
early to Obama that it was influential.
God, it's going to be a long, long campaign. Claire Malone, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, David.
You can read Claire Malone's column on the media and politics at newyorker.com. The Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments in a case that could have tremendous impact on the presidential election. This is the Colorado case, deciding whether Donald Trump should be eligible to be on the ballot in the state of Colorado. The plaintiffs, who include a 91-year-old Republican, argue that Trump should be disqualified because of a clause in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. Jill Lepore, a historian and staff writer for The New Yorker, joins our podcast, The Political Scene, this week to talk about the history behind that amendment and the stakes of the case.
The reason this case exists is that Republicans in the Senate failed to do their constitutional duty and convict Donald Trump of impeachment in January of 2021. And I think that's really important to remember. The proper way to deal with the insurrection on January 6th was indeed to impeach Donald Trump, which the House did, and then the Senate, by a very narrow margin, failed to reach the two-thirds majority, right? It has now come out in several memoirs that some of the, I believe it was 10 senators that were needed to convict Trump, were persuaded to vote against conviction because of threats against their families. And Mitch McConnell said, of course, at the time that he voted against convicting Trump of impeachment because he thought this was a matter for the criminal courts. That was the wrong decision, right? Trump should have been impeached and he would have then been disqualified. The criminal prosecutions that are now proceeding very, very slowly are, you know, another way to confront the problem of a president who has engaged in insurrection. But this is not the best solution.
That's Jill Lepore speaking on The Political Scene, a podcast from The New Yorker. And this is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'll be back in a moment with Jacqueline Novak, whose Netflix special, Get on Your Knees, is what everybody in the comedy world is talking about right now. So stick around.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What if we could block a protein to stop runaway cell division? Dana-Farber laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, sex jokes have been around since forever. You may know the old one about the women who decide to withhold from their men until they knock off fighting a war, the Peloponnesian War. The men get in a huff, they walk around in, let's say, an extended state of agony, and finally, they cave in. The war ends. A great celebration ensues. That's the plot of the comedy Lysistrata, a play by Aristophanes from 411 BC. It's a pretty great political joke, political and sexual at the same time. Now, a few millennia later, comedian Jacqueline Novak works a similar groove, but she's created something entirely original. Her debut on Netflix is a show called Get on Your Knees. It's a comedy special, sure, but not at all a string of setups and punchlines. You can get that anywhere. Novak's performance is a rant. It's blazingly fast, full of allusions and sly jokes and political potshots that go by so quickly that you'll sometimes miss a few of them and want to watch again. It's about sex, power, the dilemmas of women, the vanities of men, not to mention the absurdities of anatomy.
Well, it's tender. It's responsive, you know, they're... It springs up under certain conditions. That's why I think it has the soul of an artist, you know? It sees something that intrigues it, and it sort of... It fills with inspiration. And it is a filling to me. It is a filling to me much more than it is a... erection. I think erection's a little architectural for what's happening there. I don't think anyone should go in that building. I don't think it's safe. It's not up to code. And unlike a building, it doesn't topple, it withers. It dies on the vine. It blooms and it withers.
Novak is deeply aware of the embarrassments that go along with sex and of just being alive, being human. And that really came through when we spoke. The narrative core of her show is an attempt at oral sex, and yet I wouldn't call it raunchy, not in the usual comedy way. There's barely an F-bomb to be heard. Nevertheless, the work is about sex, and there's some slang that isn't bleeped on our podcast, just so you know. For an hour plus, there's more material crammed into this space than I would think any other comedian's 2 hours or three hours. And it has to be something that you wrote and wrote and worked and worked and rewrote and rewrote. What's the precedent for this? I can't think of an exact or even remotely exact precedent for you. Who are your heroes in this, or who are you looking toward, or are you just dangling out there on your own?
Well, I always wanted to be like Chris Rock. I wanted to stock the stage and kind of to have a kind of like rabid enthusiasm about things that I desire to desperately communicate with other people. Like, you know,
how did you begin to conceive it and construct
it? It comes out of me trying to take a huge swing, like funny girl going in, like Mr. Ziegfeld, here I am, you know, like, and then, you know, could I sort of do this thing that's this sort of blowjob show, but then it's this other thing or this other thing, but can I still convince them I'm doing stand-up? You know, like, I'm very consumed with, I guess, being understood, like just like in a core sort of wound way or something like that.
Were you concerned that what you were doing before was too limited or derivative or anything like that, and this is the real you, and I'm gonna try to hit it over the wall?
I mean, the late night set, for, you know, for example, you're this guest, so to me it feels like, okay, I got to go out and I'm gonna sing a little tune, you know, like I'm gonna sing a little tune in the tradition of stand up comedy, and there's something satisfying and kind of fun about doing it on it's exactly its own terms versus almost, I don't know, going out there and sort of being a star in 5 minutes in this ragged sort of way that it's like there's something in me that wants to fulfill the assignment. And, you know.
Was there a moment where you thought of a line, an idea, a word, anything that you go, that's what this is going to be about? And
right.
And that's why it's going to be both funny and right. original.
So in college, I wrote an essay. And the essay was very much elements of this narrative of kind of going from remembering this first time that I heard about the blowjob and then kind of my evolving thoughts about it through the years. That in combination with sort of stand-up and things I've been working on in the stand-up context in a very simplistic way, like, okay, I've stumbled on doing these jokes about, you know, the penis, which like I don't even like saying it. I'm like, I can't even believe that like I've ended up there. You know, like, that is not the plan. Like, when other people make a joke about the penis or something, I don't mean to be talking about these things.
Well, how many times did you perform it before the Netflix taping?
You know, I wish I knew this number, like, because it's like, I remember getting to 100 shows back at, like, during the first run, but then I toured it, and that was probably, like, another 50 shows, and then and then I did another run, so that was probably another 100 shows. Like,
so we're up to 300.
I weirdly don't know. And this is, I mean, I guess someone could do the math. Like, I'm like, 1,000? I'm like, or is it like 260? Like, I'm like, no clue.
I noticed that you wear a uniform for this show that's yes. not necessarily your usual uniform. You wear yeah. jeans, a kind of baggy gray t-shirt, and sneakers. And in other performances, you've worn... You know, you've kind of dressed up more. Mm-hmm. What was behind that decision?
Yeah. It was the attempt to completely sort of neutralize, and like, you can never neutralize the body or you know, the fetal form or anything. It just made sense to wear the thing that let me be as close to a mind for me, which is, and that might be something else for someone else, but for me, jeans, a t-shirt, sneakers, I basically forget my body, which is sort of the goal.
And you want us to as well.
You know, I take the stage, you show up, you get to look, and fair enough, but it is a nightmare. It is a nightmare for an intellectual like myself. Now, I like to keep it moving on stage, because I know how you people operate, okay? Okay, I stand still for too long, you see something you like, you take a mental snapshot, who knows what you'll do with it later. I prefer to keep things moving, keep them blurry, thank you very much. Try to take a mental snapshot of it. Nothing but a gray blur. Simple self-preservation.
And what's it like to perform it? I finished watching it a second time. I thought, this must be physically and mentally both exhilarating but exhausting. Really hard to do.
There's a sense of, like, sort of filling myself up, gearing up, winding myself up, and then just, like, and then letting it all unfurl and sort of left with nothing at the end. And it would sort of be like lightly fasting during the day, you know, but trying not to have nothing, like not to be like completely depleted by the time, but like nervous, you know, just the nervous thing. And then like ritual meal after, which is just the greatest, like such a huge part of the like physical experience of the show.
No, you need to just do it. Well, you're not a just do a person. Do you even listen to yourself? I don't care if you're an overthinker who wishes she had a second mouth to narrate her every experience, or everyone would know that I know that she knows about jingle jangle, this life awareness. No, you need to find the way. Well, Nietzsche said there is no way. There's only my way. And find Nietzsche's way. Then find your way. I have to find a way.
Let's talk about the speed.
Yeah.
There's obviously an idea behind the speed. I think you pause for breath twice to grab the most Spartan glass
right.
of water off a little teeny shelf in the back of the theater.
I opted for the shelf.
It's just nothing.
I struck the stool and opted for the shelf.
And so what's the thinking about the speed? Because I think for some listeners, it can be too fast. You're missing stuff the way you might
yeah.
a complicated piece of music.
Well, it worked for me as a live show in that people would come back. After they say, I want to read it or something, you know,
right.
like, and I do think it basically comes out of, you know, some version of, insecurity. I mean, it's, you know, you didn't like this, you didn't like this. Well, don't worry. I'm moving off it. You know, it's like, we got to get through this. Like, cause I have a lot to say, like, you know, like I have this grand theory of everything in my mind that I'm building towards. And in order to get you there, I have to take you through this journey with this specific thing because I need to give you these details. But along the way, wait, I need to explain. You probably think I think this about this and I need to explain I actually think this about this. So there's some kind of compulsion in there. I need to be tilted forward, like into the wind, like running, you know, I'm leaning against the wind. It's like I'm using all of my struggles, like, or like, you know, my like focus stuff, like, don't interrupt me. I won't be able to hold the train of thought. I can't look at you. I just have to keep moving or I'll drown, you know, or whatever. And I'm sort of letting those flaws, struggles, whatever, you know, I'm like, allowing them and letting those be perceived as like my style. You know, it'd almost be like, you know, like, oh, well, your style is neurotic or your style is, and it's like, it's not like, you know, you seek, it's like, no, I think I'm preaching. The neurotic is just coming in against my intentions. It's not like I wore like a neurotic hat because I thought like, wouldn't it be fun to be a neurotic act or
right.
something? I don't even say I'm neurotic. I just, you know, just as an example.
Jacqueline, you spend at least 20 minutes talking about the penis and at one point call it, and I love this, a drama queen.
Penis is yes. sensitive. The penis is the nag. The penis is the drama queen. I mean, the ultimate drama queen. Just 1 minute, life of the party. And then the very next, just flopped over and sulking on the fainting couch that is the inner thigh, just waiting for someone to notice that, frankly, she's upset.
It really comes down to my sort of obsession with how things we take for granted, like metaphor and in language, you know, are choices, even if made unconsciously and by the group over time, right? Like, that is just compelling to me. I sort of have a permanent irritation with the way that it's forgotten that those were sort of choices, you know, that everything's literary in some way.
Right.
And, you know, I'm talking about this irritation that I was unable to totally understand at the time, but looking back, I can go, okay, I was expected to accept this idea of the penis as this just male, you know, this fearsome object. I wasn't able to quite realize that, like, contradiction at the time, you know? It's, like, more like later, I'm like, yeah, so I was so, you know, it's, like, acting like the penis, like, I felt like I was expected to sort of act like the penis was this one thing while also doing this opposite thing. But then I was also dealing with this serious fear of, you know, the toothy blowjob and this like, wait, this thing that I'm being expected to do is like putting it at risk massively. Like, it is not strong. Like, it is, it's the one, you know, part on whatever, the boyfriend, you know, in my case that like, I don't want to accidentally elbow. Like, it's literally, like, the tender area. So it's, like, it's weird.
So Carrie Batten, who wrote a wonderful profile of you in The New Yorker recently, said this: shame is the root of most comedy. But Novak prefers to grapple with shame's more free-spirited and familiar cousin, embarrassment.
Yeah. So I enjoy identifying kind of embarrassment, right? I kind of, I've always felt like I have a meter for it, like a really sensitive sort of, like, ear for embarrassment, you know? What's the word when people have, perfect pitch, you know, like they can hear it, like the ear. Anyway, I've always felt like just this, that's embarrassing, let me tell you why, right? And in the context of the show, when I do this kind of, like, you know, all the energy I've expended to coddle your ego, so to speak, you know, poeticize your flaws, that's on me. I did that, right? I did that. I enjoyed it even.
A lot of comedians, or at least some comedians lately, have been obsessed with cancel culture. They see as a burden, or at least they're obsessed with the sense that it's harder to tell jokes. Now, you hear this with Ricky Gervais, you hear it with Dave Chappelle. And is that an issue for you, or are some subjects?
No,
tell me about that.
Yeah, I just think it's like we're artists, like we're fine. You know what I mean? Like, to me, like, choosing to make art of any kind, right, is sort of this self-appointment, you know? No one's asking you to do it. So it's sort of weird for me to kind of get into a mindset as though, like, you're owed any comfort or any... It's not like you were forced into being an artist and the conditions are... you know, the conditions aren't what we were promised. Like, that's never, right? Isn't that sort of, that's never the case.
Did you
that's
think that the critique of Dave Chappelle was and is wrongheaded or legit?
I mean,
when it comes to trans jokes and you know.
To me, despite being willing almost to talk about my own sort of comedy, like, I'm basically, like, unwilling almost to, like, there's something to me sort of commenting outside of comedy, sort of about comedy in this way, like, I'm very resistant to it.
Why is that?
It's just sort of, then I'm no longer the artist. It's like, I guess anything where it's like, it used to be easier to be X or Y kind of artist or something like that, whatever it is, like, it's like, what? Like, what are we talking about here? It's not a job anyone's guaranteed. Like, it's acting like the culture is responsible for the artist's experience, like, it doesn't even make sense to me.
And Jacqueline, there's a part of the show where you compare the men in your life to toddlers, miming the act of placing bumpers around the house so they don't injure themselves. Mm. Male fragility is a big theme. The idea that men need to think of ourselves as potent and impressive, and we'll have a meltdown if anybody suggests otherwise.
I completely own that it's a projection. Like, I don't, it's not... It's really important to me and John Early when we were working on the show.
John Early was a collaborator of yours in developing it.
In that section where I'm saying, I do this and I do this and I bend over backwards to make sure that you don't feel, you know, embarrassment or whatever. I don't actually like that. I don't want to come out here and stand up and say, you know, male fragility. Like, I'm really not trying to do that, but it happens sort of. Any headline about the show, like, if it said something about male fragility, I'd be like, no, you know, like, or if it were like trolls the penis, I'd be like, no, like, it's like any of these statements. And I always feel this way. It's like, if you could say what, if you could say what the thing meant, you wouldn't have had to say the thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's in the form.
If you could summarize it.
Yeah, then why write a show? Yeah, so the summary is sort of this lie that maybe gets people to go then kind of experience it and experiencing it hopefully in all of its tensions. And
That's well said.
And then that sends them back into the fray where it complicates again. So yeah, that's really it.
Jacqueline Novak, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jacqueline Novak's comedy special is called Get on Your Knees. It's showing on Netflix. And there's a terrific profile of Novak in the magazine by staff writer Carrie Batten. And you can find it at newyorker.com.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What if we could block a protein to stop runaway cell division? Dana-Farber laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RadioHour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In 2018, the New Yorker published an essay about reckoning with the death of a mother. It was called Crying in H Mart, and its author was Michelle Zauner, the musician who fronts the band Japanese Breakfast. It was a lovely essay, and she kept writing and writing and expanded the essay into a book finally, a memoir about culture and family and loss and food, a lot of food. People say they got hungry reading her descriptions of cooking Korean dishes with her mother. Crying in H Mart, the book, spent over a year on the bestseller list.
H Mart is freedom from the single-aisle ethnic section in regular grocery stores. They don't prop Goya beans next to bottles of sriracha here. Instead, you'll likely find me crying by the banchan refrigerators, remembering the taste of my mom's soy sauce eggs and cold radish soup. Or in the freezer section, holding a stack of dumpling skins, thinking of all the hours that Mom and I spent at the kitchen table folding minced pork and chives into the thin dough. Sobbing near the dry goods, asking myself, am I even Korean anymore if there's no one left to call and ask which brand of seaweed we used to buy?
That's Michelle Zauner, reading from Crying in H Mart. At the New Yorker Festival recently, Zauner sat down to talk with the New Yorker's Hua Xu. And it was really a meeting of minds because Hua also wrote a memoir called Stay True, which won the Pulitzer Prize last year. Both extraordinary books. And here's Hua Xu speaking with Michelle Zauner.
Michelle, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm very nervous.
No, you're not.
I am, yes.
He was like eating a Rice Krispie treat like right before we went on. I was like, wow, you're so chill. Like walking up the stairs with a Rice Krispie treat.
I can't believe you told everyone that I did that. the book, which I'm sure everyone here has read, Crying in H Mart. I guess I'm contractually obliged to ask you whether people recognize you at H Mart.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't get recognized in H Mart very often. And actually, like, the only time I've wanted to, like, bust out any, like, celebrity cred is, like, when, like, the security guard at the, like, East Village location was, like, really mean to me. And I wanted, like, I couldn't figure out how to put the, like, basket in the cart. And he was, like, really mean about it. And I wanted to be like, do you know who I am?
You should have, like, pointed to the monitor.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they have that video.
They don't
here,
have them there. That's probably why.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Even when I did that, though, I was, like, checking out at the register. And I was like, oh, that's me. The Ajumma was really just like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Take your rice and go.
So the book grew out of an essay you wrote for The New Yorker. Thank you, and you're also welcome. So I'm just curious, like, when you finish the book and the book comes out, like, how did you change over the course of writing it, if you feel like you did?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you had this experience, but I mean, I think that writing memoir really forces you to have like some radical compassion for people that you may or may not feel ready to have or like want to have, you know? I mean, there is a first version of this book that was so angry at my dad and at myself and at every person in my life. And, you know, one really beautiful thing about writing a book is that it takes so much time and it forces you to have so much perspective. You know, when I submitted the rough draft, I didn't get it back for 3 or 4 months. So when I reread it, I think I didn't realize I was so angry and how much I was holding in and how much I really needed to let go if I wanted to tell this story honestly and fairly. And so I think I was able to see, you know, other perspectives a bit more clearly and find a lot of forgiveness for myself and the people that were involved in this very difficult time in all of our lives.
You know, I'm wondering, like, how did your relationship to your mother change after you finished writing this?
I feel like I have a deeper understanding of her. I don't know if you've, I mean, I know you don't want to talk about Stay True, but I had such a wonderful, I mean, I'm talking to a Pulitzer winning writer right now who has an amazing memoir called Stay True, and I read it this week and enjoyed it so much. And, you know, it's impossible to not think about how very similar they are and also how very different. One thing I thought was sort of interesting was, you know, the first line of my book is, ever since my mom died, I cry in H Mart. And so much of your book it's really not mentioned until, I mean, it's a discovery that sort of happens that your friend has died, and it's sort of towards like the end of, not, I don't think that's spoiling anything, but it's sort of towards the end of the book, and it's interesting to see how differently we handled grief and sharing this story of loss. But for me personally, it was such a joy to kind of try to see things from my mother's side and share parts of her. And I think part of the joy of being a writer is like being a sort of detective and unraveling parts of their person. And I think I learned so much more I feel like I had a deeper understanding and I felt much closer to her after writing the book.
That's beautiful. I mean, I think that, you know, you are a detective. You're also sort of like a time traveler. Like you can sort of go back and relive things that you may not have appreciated the first time around.
And I also think it was like proof that I really loved this person because my mom and I had such a tumultuous relationship that I almost felt like I needed to get the facts straight that we really loved each other. It was just complicated and I felt this need to prove that. And I feel like, you know, towards the end of the book, you also kind of confront that where you're like, were we really as close as I thought we were? And you're sort of like convincing yourself and exploring this relationship and all of its complexities and validating for yourself of like, yeah, we did really love each other. We were really connected and close. And I think that was a part of that writing process as well.
So, you know, one thing that I talked to you about a year and a half ago, I think, and at the time, you were working on adapting your memoir for the screen. Is there anything you can share about sort of like your approach or how you're going to think about doing it?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I didn't write very much about in the book was, you know, my musical life. And I just love, I mean, that was such a big part of my teenage years was like that sort of discovery. And I think also towards the end of the book, I sort of began to realize, you know, I didn't want anyone to get confused that this was like, you know, this is how it became Shell's Honor of Japanese Breakfast. Like, I'm not like Keith Richards or something. But I avoided writing too much about it until I realized like that was a really big part of my, you know, major rift with my mother. It was a really big part of our relationship. And when we sort of started to argue with one another was this like this calling I felt I had and this real passion that she was so confused by and so against. And, you know, it's just such a different craft. It's really funny. You have to find like, I started compiling a list of like adverbs because you have to like describe, you know, leaving a room or smiling or looking at someone in like so many different ways. And you have to be really smart and short about it. And it's almost like there's this kind of like ad agency like lingo. So it's quite different.
So there was this moment, I don't know if it was, I've lost complete track of like the last 2 years, but there was this moment where you perform with Karen O.
Yeah.
And also the Linda Lindas.
Yeah.
And you posted this like incredibly like moving note where you talked about sort of Karen O's role in sort of like being able to understand yourself and see yourself. I do feel like it is like a generational thing where it does seem like a lot of younger artists, particularly in this AAPI space, are kind of looking out for each other in a way that may not have been as obvious in the 80s or 90s when there was like more competition.
I was really lucky and so much of my career was assisted by Mitski, who took me on tour in 2016. And it was really cool to have, you know, at the time, like she was like the hot Asian girl in indie and like she could have like really like coveted that position and not wanted to like share. And I feel like one thing that's really cool about our generation is that like we've really started to dissect that like internalized misogyny and racism and try to like lend a helping hand, whereas like maybe even in the 90s like they would pit women against each other and it would be hard not to kind of believe that. And it's really nice now. I feel like we have such a wonderful community where like we're really helping each other and are trying to push for you know, bringing each other on tour and sharing each other's work and supportive, having like a supportive network with one another. And so I try to take part in that.
That's awesome. You're moving soon.
Yeah, so I'm moving to Korea to live for a year and work on my second book, where I am going to study the language and document that process. And I think it was such a natural response to writing a book that was so rooted in the past, and so much of what was hard about it was like, it was so obviously emotional, but also, you know, it was hard to remember all of that. So I'm really looking forward to writing about, you know, the day-to-day experience of living in another country and learning a language. Yeah, I guess, like, the thing I'm most worried about is just, like, being too dumb to learn. Because I, you know, I've gone to Koreans. I never, like, cared enough about it until, you know, you get older and you, like, start paying for school and tutors yourself. But, and I'm really curious, like, how it will go to be fully immersed and have my one job to be a student. And I'm most excited to just be completely consumed by one thing. I just want to do one thing and to, like, go to school and focus on one skill.
Wait, you're going to be an actual, like, student?
Yeah, I'm going to go to classes, and I'm most excited to, like, live in a city where people have manners. Because I think that, you know, our country is getting out of hand. I'm so looking forward to everyone standing to one side of the escalator.
Yeah.
That is what I'm, like, most excited about. And the idea of, like, someone not watching a video on their phone on the subway without headphones. Like, there's no way anyone in Korea is doing that. And I'm looking forward to never being around that for a full year.
That does sound great. That's all we have time for. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Michelle Zauner is the author of Crying in H Mart and leads the band Japanese Breakfast. She spoke with Hua Xu. Hua's memoir is called Stay True, and you can read him on all manner of things at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining me this hour. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Mike Kutchman, Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.